right, ladies and gentlemen, shall we begin? And all right, that's 10% less enthusiastic than I needed, but we'll go ahead and do it anyway. Good afternoon. My name is Don Jones. We are going to be talking about turning Windows PowerShell commands into reusable command line interface and graphical user interface tools. We are going to use PowerShell to build a GUI. This will probably hurt a little, but we're going to do it anyway. Before we begin, just a quick bit about what we're going to do, a little bit about myself. How many of you have used PowerShell just a little bit to maybe run a command or two? Awesome. How many of you have got less technically skilled colleagues that you would love to be able to give stuff to, but you know they're going to get it wrong? You are in the right place. So we're going to take some commands and use them to build a tool that we can give to someone else. And we're going to make these tools look, feel, smell, and taste just like a native PowerShell command, so that somebody who knows a little bit about how to use the shell can follow the same practices and patterns when they're using our tools. So we're going to wrap these commands up in a way that just makes them easier to use. The word I have invented for this is tool maker. You are going to go from being a tool user banging rocks together to a tool maker creating the rocks to give to other people to bang together. It makes you a little bit higher up in the organization. It means you're the only one who knows how everything actually works, which does lead to better job security. And it also keeps your hands from getting as dirty. Sorry, I can't fight that fire. I'm making tools. Which leads to telecommuting. Yes, big fan of telecommuting. Stay home. Quick bit about myself. My name, again, is Don Jones. I'm a Windows PowerShell MVP award recipient. I am an independent trainer. I do not work for Microsoft, so anything I say does not commit the company to doing anything. They probably wish I wasn't here. Who knows? This is my website, itpro.concentratedtech.com, if you're interested. I did write a book called Learn Windows PowerShell in a Month of Lunches. And this self-published one, Windows PowerShell Scripting and Toolmaking, is actually not available. I'm writing a bigger, badder, awesomer version of it. So I'm going to give you my contact information in just a little bit, because I can tell you how to get both of those things pretty soon. I'm also the Windows PowerShell columnist for Microsoft TechNet Magazine. Does anybody read that? It's at technetmagazine.com. It's online. It's in 13 languages. There's no reason not to go up there. I publish a new blog or article every single month. It's even copy edited, so the words are spelled correctly. Now, hopefully, if you're here, you're already familiar with how to do whatever administrative stuff you're trying to do. You should have some familiarity, and I believe everybody said they did, running just basic PowerShell commands, running a command, hit enter, things happen. You do not specifically need a scripting or programming background to be here. We are actually not going to be doing a lot of programming. However, it wouldn't hurt. The more of that background you have, the quicker you'll be able to go further. But I want to emphasize that PowerShell is really built in stages. So as you start doing stuff, you'll run into a wall. You know, I need to know one more thing in order to do this. And you'll learn that one thing. And you can eventually learn the entire darn shell one little thing at a time. And that makes it a lot more approachable. So by that same token, understand that this is a breakout session at a conference. We are going to go from 0 to 300 miles an hour, possibly Mach 1, very, very quickly. You do not need to immediately go home and grasp all of this. You can take just the bits you need for that job right then and do it one chunk at a time. And that is a much better way to learn it than trying to sit and choke down the whole thing all at once. This session is about 99% demo, which means it is mostly PowerShell and not PowerPoint. There are some slides in this deck, which you guys all have access to through the MyTechEd portal. You've got access to the whole deck. There are some slides in here I will not actually be covering. They're only in there to act as some syntax reminders to you later. What's more important is that every single script I write here, because we're really just going to build a couple of big tools, I'm going to zip them up and put them online. And if you watch my Twitter feed tomorrow or later today or this week, I will give you the URL where you can download everything that I've created here in the class. So hopefully that will be useful for everybody. If you are interested, I know the bookstore is sold out of my PowerShell in a Month of Lunches. We have just released the version 3 edition of that book in preview mode. You can get it for half off. Again, there's a coupon code in the URL in my Twitter feed. So even if you're not a Twitterer, whatever, you can just go up there. It's just a web page. You can just look at it. Twitter.com/concentrateddon. If this tool making is something that you think you might want to do more of and take further and maybe even work with some of your colleagues, there's the book for that too. Again, watch the Twitter feed. There's also some video training I've done. I've put a few little things on the tables up front. If you want to grab one of those at the end of the session, you're more than welcome. I'm going to put that in my Twitter feed too, because I'm counting the number of people in the room, and there's like 10. So again, just put that up there. It's a good way for me to put that out there. If you have a question as we go, please ask it. You may need to stand up. I'm pretty good at hearing today. I stayed away from the jet engines last night. So you don't probably need to go to the mic. I'll repeat the question for everyone. But you may have to stand up in order for me to see you. If you're just waving your arms, I've got these two miniature suns here. I might not see you. So feel free to also scream, shout, throw things at someone next to you so that they make noise. We'll get it going in here. OK, so with that, let's just hop right into PowerShell. I'm going to run a command that's fairly simple. I want to emphasize here that the point of this session is not doing complicated things with PowerShell. The point is taking whatever it is you know how to do in the shell and turning it into a tool. So I'm going to keep the command simple so that we can focus on building it into a tool. I'm going to do a pretty basic inventory tool. I want to run get wmyobject, and I want to get, let's see, we'll do the Win32 operating system class from a computer, and I'll start just with localhost. Okay, that worked. There's several pieces of information there I want to grab. I also want to grab some things out of the computer system class. Manufacturer, model, stuff like that. Okay, that information is there. And let's just keep it interesting by adding one more. See, this is why you run these things first. There we go, BIOS. I'll grab the serial number. Some manufacturers even put their call tag information in there, so that's a good one to grab. Again, not trying to do a complicated task here, trying to focus on building that into a tool. So the way I like to sort of walk through this process is to start very, very simple, identify things I don't like about that phase of the operation, and then add more to accommodate that. In other words, we're going to kind of take this in steps and continue to add to this. If you're a big fan of taking pictures of the screen, that's an awesome way to do this. You should be able to capture a lot of it. Most of it will fit on one page. We are going to come back and make several rounds of modifications to this. So let's just start with a simple copy-paste. Is everybody familiar with copy-paste? Okay. You know, it can get you into trouble if you copy something that's broken, but let's put that on the clipboard and paste it here into the shell. Now, one of the tricks with making a tool about PowerShell is you need to exercise a little bit of design up front. I like to build tools that are task-focused, meaning each tool I build does one of three things. It either gets something that's intended to be fed to another tool, such as retrieving computer names from the directory or retrieving computer names from a CMDB. That's one tool. The next tool does something. And that's the type we're going to build here. This is going to query inventory information from one or more computers. The other type of tool you can build, the third type, is designed to take output from a previous tool and format it, or convert it to a different display, or make it into HTML, or whatever else you might want to do with it. And I'm going to show you when we get done with this first tool here why it's important to maintain that differentiation, why it's important to have each one do only one thing at a time. One of the rules that you need to work with in PowerShell is that if a tool is producing output, which this one's going to, it's going to output inventory information, you need to output one kind of thing. In other words, I can't just paste my three getWmyObject commands in here and run it. Each of those commands is each producing a separate kind of output. That would be three different kinds of output. I don't want that. What I want to do is take the bits of information I care about and combine them into a consolidated form of output. So to get me started on that, I'm going to just make sure this thing gets stuck into a variable. And then we will use the venerable copy and paste method of the demonstration. And let's see, we'll put the BIOS into a variable, and we will put the computer system into a variable. So here's the first bit of magic. I really want that to be a C. Here's the first bit of magic. I'm going to decide what I want my output to contain. First of all, I'd like it to contain the computer name, which is currently localhost. And let's see, we'll also grab the OS version, and that's going to be in the operating system version property. We'll grab the service pack version. We'll grab the BIOS serial number. We already talked about that one. Serial. And what did I say, model and manufacturer? Does that sound plausible? Okay, this structure I've built is called a hash table. If you've gotten some programming experience, you might know this as an associative array, or a dictionary object, or a bunch of key value pairs. That's what it is. I get to make up my own keys. This is what I want my output to be titled, computer name, OS version, SP version, and so forth. And then the values are the things that I've already queried using Windows Management instrumentation. So I've constructed my output. Now, to actually make that output, I am going to create a new object. Because PowerShell loves objects. It doesn't really deal with text as awesomely as it deals with objects. And you'll see when we finish this all the cool things I get to do with it then. There's actually a special type of object called a PS object, PowerShell object. This is intended as a blank canvas for you to paint your future onto. So I'm going to create a new one of these and ask it to attach all those little properties that I just created. And then I'm going to use the command write output to spit that out to the shell. Let's save this. We'll just call it test for now, test.ps1. Hop down here into the shell. I probably need to turn on scripting. I'm sure. Ruh-roh. Oh. I need to be an admin. Bloop, bloop. And I need to not be running the 32-bit version of the shell. How many of you are running a 64-bit version of the operating system? Yeah, so pay real close attention. I can't believe I messed this up, but I'm just going to pretend I did it so I could show it to you. You've got two different versions of PowerShell. Wow, it's got bright in here. You've got the x86, which is your 32-bit, and then other one. It's the other one you want, and you want to run it as administrator. There we go. Let's just make that font a little more readable. There we are. Set execution policy. Remote signed. I'm sure. Ah, good, it worked. Now let's run my little script. Cool. So I've queried the local host. I've gotten three different hunks of information and combined those together into a consolidated output. The reason I want that consolidated output, how many of you might write a tool like this and be happy with the output on the screen? Okay? Where else might you want that output to go? A CSV file? Yeah? Would anyone want it maybe in an HTML that you could put onto an intranet web server? Nodding some heads. Okay, what about maybe into an XML file? Great. When you write a function that only does one thing, this is just retrieving some information and it's outputting it as objects, you don't have to work very hard to get those other things. If you want it in a file, you put it in the file. If you want it in a CSV file, you put it in a CSV file. If you want it to be HTML, so by creating a tool that doesn't worry about how the output's going to be used, it's just generating the raw data, I no longer have to work hard to get all these different forms of output. PowerShell already knows how to take objects and then convert them and export them and so forth. If I needed to export it to some never-before-heard-of format, I would write a separate tool called export-never-before-heard-of format. So each tool you write focuses on generating input, doing something, or doing something with the output of a previous tool. So you break them down that way, and that way you wind up doing less work. A single tool remains more functional for you. We do have a bit of a problem here, and that is the hard-coded local host. Who sees that as a potential problem? Yeah. Well, here's what I suggest we do. We're going to give this to the help desk and just tell them, look, before you run it, you need to go change localhost to four times. No, okay. Let's create a parameter for that. This is going to be a string. And I'm going to call it computer name, because whenever PowerShell has a command that accepts a computer name, it does so on a minus computer name parameter. I just want to be consistent with that. Let's create a default value for it so that if somebody tries to run this, it does something. And then we're going to utilize that instead of our hard-coded localhost. Let's save it. Try it again. Dash computer tab. Oh, because it's actually reading the script, seeing that there's a parameter for computer name, and letting me tab complete it. So now I'll just punch in localhost, make sure it works. And because I put in a default, it should work even if I run it without the parameter. Who thinks localhost is an intelligent default value? Yeah, not a lot of convincing going on here. What would you rather see? You want to prompt for it. Okay, let's prompt for it. Who wants to prompt for it? Pretend you're with me. All right. We're going to turn on a bunch of magic by simply adding a commandlet binding directive to the top here. That adds a bunch of features without us having to do any work, and we're going to start taking advantage of those. It technically makes this into what Microsoft calls an advanced script. You'll see that referred to more often as an advanced function, which we will turn this into eventually. A lot of people will call this a script commandlet. So if you're out on the intertubes searching for something, script commandlet will sometimes get you some hits that advanced script or advanced function won't. But we are, now that we've used that, we can tell PowerShell, hey, on this particular parameter, make it mandatory. And now I don't need this default value. Save. Run it. Hey, dude, I need a computer name. Fine, localhost, enter, great. Run it again, don't give it a name, fails. That's what you want. That's the same behavior every PowerShell command exhibits. If somebody is getting used to the way PowerShell works, this works the same way. Now, this only takes one computer name. Do any of you in any of your environments have more than one computer? Just checking. I have some Microsoft stock, and more than one is good. So let's tell this to accept multiple computer names. All I have to do is jam those two square brackets next to each other in there like that, and all of a sudden, this is an array. Here's a really cool thing about PowerShell. Even if I run this with only one value on computer name, I've told PowerShell that this must be an array, and so it will implicitly create an array of one item so that I can only have to deal with multiple possible values. My script only has to know one potential situation. And so all I'm going to do is enumerate through those one at a time for each computer in computer named. I'm going to indent all this, because people who don't indent their blocked code go to hell. It's true. It's true. And now I need, because $computer is what's going to have a single computer, I just need to do that. We save it. Run test. Let's just give it this a few times, because I don't have a whole mess of computers here to play with. So comma delimited by PowerShell is always read as an array, comma delimited list of values. So I should get 1, 2, 3. Now what if I try to run it without anything? What do you think? Still prompts me, but notice what it says after computer name. Hit enter when you're done, and it runs. Standard PowerShell behavior. You don't have to write any extra code to take advantage of that. It's awesome. Now, what we can't do is very easily provide input to this via other mechanisms, and I'd like to do that next. I'd like to be able to pipe in computer names. Remember what I said before? I don't care where the computer names are coming from. I don't care if you're typing them. They're coming from a text file. They're coming from Active Directory. They're coming from a miracle that happened in the sky. It doesn't matter to me. I'm just taking computer names. What I want to make it easy to do is get the computer names in here no matter where you got them from. So one way to do that is to tell this thing that, hey, this can also accept value from pipeline. Now, when you decide to start running a tool in the pipeline, you have to take a couple of extra steps because PowerShell looks for some specific things. It looks for some named script blocks called begin, process, and end. Because I put that in a block, I have to indent it. Save my soul. Okay. Here's how this works. When this is run normally, as we've been doing it, by using the computer name parameter and giving it values, whatever's in the begin block will execute first, whatever's in process will execute next, whatever is in end will execute third. If you don't have anything to put in begin and end, you don't have to put them there. You can leave them out. You don't have to have the empty ones there. I do it compulsively because I'm an instructor and I like things to look just like that. When this is run in the pipeline, the begin block will execute first, the end block will execute last, and process will be executed one time for each thing that was piped in. So PowerShell is going to sort of automatically unwind that pipeline input for us. It's going to essentially look something like this. I need to put them in strings on this end of the pipeline so that PowerShell knows, sorry, in quotes, so that it knows these are strings. If I just put localhost, comma, localhost, comma, localhost, it would think that was a command to run. And it would tell me, dude, that's not a command. You're smoking. So now let's pipe that to test. Boom, boom, boom. So now, any way you have of getting computer names in there, oops, I meant get content names.txt. Any way you have of getting strings into the pipeline can now be fed to this. Get them from Active Directory, get them from a file, type them in yourself, do whatever you want to do. You can feed these things right along. So now this is playing and working well in the pipeline. Cool? What's really cool is when you run help. Give me some help on this test thing, because I haven't figured out how to use it yet. Well, all right, let's do better. Now, if you were in my session earlier with Jeffrey Snover, anybody? All right, this will be a little bit of a repeat. But for those of you who've done scripting and programming, who believes that you should put documentation into your scripts? Who believes you shouldn't? Okay, yeah, once, yeah, okay. You're just being contrary. We're going to do that. Show me that help again. So you can see this parsed that comment, constructed the synopsis. I didn't add a description, or that would be populated too. Descriptions can be obviously much longer. It's got a nicer breakdown of the syntax. It shows me that computer name is a string. It accepts multiple values. You can see the, wait, did I do examples? I did examples, right? Minus full. There we go. Shows me the help for the computer name parameter, one or more computer names or IP addresses. Shows me that it's mandatory. Shows me that it goes in the first position. Shows me that it accepts pipeline input by value. Numbers my examples for me, because counting is hard. Now this is working and feeling like a real PowerShell command. Continuing to add things to it to make it smarter and more consistent with everything else that the shell does. How many of you like to see step-by-step progress output? Yeah? All right. Let's put that up here. Write verbose about to query $computer. You know, I just realized there's a monitor down front, and I'm like, what the hell are all these people looking at? All right, let's stick that in there, and we're going to run this test again. Let's go back and grab one of these previous. There we go, that'll work. Oh, no verbose output. Because you know why? Sometimes you don't always want a chatty computer. Sometimes you want it to just shut up and get on with it. So all I have to do is add minus verbose, and it turns on that output. That's cool, because it means when I don't want to see it, I don't have to look at it, nor do I have to go back through my script and comment those things out or remove them. The idea here is to write a tool once, get it working, which the Lord knows is hard enough, and never have to touch it again. Because what happens if you touch it again? You break it. So I will put those little, in fact, how many of you believe that scripts should also have some inline comments about what it's doing? That's what that is. I tend to rely on write verbose for those inline comments a lot. Not exclusively. I will still put inline comments in there from time to time, especially if it's stuff like Y2K, don't touch. But I want those to be visible to the person running the script so they can follow it, and write verbose lets me accomplish both of those goals in one step. So I tend to use this a lot now, and you'll notice the little trick with double quotation marks there. If you stick a variable into double quotes, PowerShell will replace it with the variable's contents. So I don't need to concatenate a whole bunch of strings together. I can get my verbose output looking nice and informative without having to do all that extra work. I want to point something out here. Those of you who have some programming and scripting in your background, anybody? Yeah, a few folks, good. There's only one bit of actual programming in here, and that's the for each loop. Everything else is just structure that tells PowerShell what's what. We are not doing a ton of programming. Yeah, we stuck some stuff into a variable, but you guys have been dealing with variables since high school algebra, I assume. So variables shouldn't be too scary. And there's not a lot of programming. It's one of the reasons it really wigs me out a little bit when people are like, oh, PowerShell is a scripting language. Yeah, PowerShell contains a scripting language, but you're not forced to use it in a big way if you don't need to. Now, I do have another minor problem with this function, as goes. First, I'm going to wipe out begin and end here because I need some room. How many of you have ever used WMI before? Yeah, okay, so if I give WMI a list of 100 computers, what's likely to happen to at least one of them? It's going to fail and time out. In my case, it's going to fail and spew an error three times because I'm querying that computer three times, and it's going to have to error out and time out three times. That's awful. The error message by default doesn't even contain the computer name. What do you say we have it suppress the error message? Because all that red text, frankly, makes me want to curl into a ball and die. I don't want to see all that red text. It's very panicky. What if we just suppress that and log it to a file instead? Yeah? Plus, if we run this as a scheduled task, that's a lot more useful than error messages that we're never going to see, isn't it? Let's do that. There's a trick with PowerShell error handling And it goes something like this. There is a top-level variable called error action preference. This is what tells PowerShell what to do when a command runs into a non-terminating error. In this case, the answer is continue, meaning I want you to try and keep going, but display an error message. If you get a script off of the internet, because I know a lot of you are going to go to the inner tubes to steal some, I mean, repurpose other people's work. If you see someone setting error action preference equal to silently continue, run in fear, because that is suppressing all error messages for the entire script, and you need to ask yourself what they're trying to hide. This is a good setting for your children when they're running around the house, right? Daddy, ow! Silently continue. Daddy needs a beer. But we're not going to set error action preference. Instead, what we're going to do is specify an alternate error action for the command where we anticipate a problem. Right like that. That says, because keep in mind, thanks to our process block in our for each loop, we're only ever going to be querying one computer at a time. We're not giving WMI a list of 100. We're only giving it one. So if it fails, we don't need it to continue. We want it to stop, because having it stop allows us to try that. And then if it doesn't work, we can catch it and do something about it. We are going to log the computer to a file. Who would rather be able to specify a different name than oops.txt? But a lot of you are on board with it. Let's add another parameter. Comma, string, error, log, path. This I am going to give a default simply because I don't feel like sitting here typing it. So now we will just copy and paste that down to our file name. And I'm going to be a pessimist and assume that this might fail multiple times, so I will just have it append that value to the file. And for now, I'll take care of deleting that each time I run this. I don't want it to auto-delete it up front. We might get there, but we're not there yet. Now, I'm doing three WMI queries. Is it safe to say that if the first one fails, the other two are probably doomed? Let's just not do them then, shall we? So before we start this, I'm going to set a variable. Glasses half full. Here's the only other scripting you're going to have to see. Now, if I give it a bad name, it'll fail on the first one, log it to in file, and skip the entire rest of it for that computer. And that little try catch block is what makes that happen. Now, I'm not really going to make use of it in this example, but does anybody foresee a need where you might want to know what the error was? There's a few ways to do that in PowerShell. Here's the way I prefer. Now, I know some of you are screen capturing, so I'm going to put a little backtick enter at the end. That's going to let me continue this on the next line so I can get a little more room. Variable names in PowerShell do not include the dollar sign. So when I use the minus error variable parameter, I give it the name of the variable, which does not include the dollar sign. When I want to access what's in the variable, I use the dollar sign. So that's the difference between those. Error action and error variable are called common parameters. They are available on every single PowerShell command in the universe, even the ones you write, because PowerShell adds them there. You do not have to code for those as a developer or as a scripter. You get that functionality pretty much for free. We're just going to take advantage of it here. So let's test this. Gosh, I hope this works. I did this one time at a customer who had a computer called Not Online on the network. And so I ran this and it worked, and I'm like, what? So it appears to not have barfed an error message. Let's run it again with verbose. Wow, awesome. So now let's look and see if that file should have Not Online in there twice, right? Because we've written it out twice now. Get content, oops. Has anybody ever written a script that had a bug in it? I haven't. Let me show you how you go about debugging. I find that bugs, particularly the tricky logic errors, not typos. Typos, you get an error message for. You can fix those. The logic errors, the one where the script doesn't spew an error, it just doesn't work correctly, 99% of the time, those are because a variable or a property does not contain the thing you thought it contained. And so what you have to do is dig in somehow and find out what's actually going on at runtime. Now, PowerShell has got some great debugging mechanisms. One of them is called breakpoints, which you can even use visually here in the ISE. You can go to debug and toggle a breakpoint, or you can do that with F9. Another way is to use the write debug. And I actually sometimes, especially for shorter little tools, I actually like that better. So here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to put in a write debug right here. Now, people aren't normally going to see this output, so it's okay to be a little snarky. We'll save that. Oops. Come back. There we go. And let's give it just a couple of good names. We'll take off the verbosity. OK, so it's still running normally. Now let's say something's gone wrong. I can just do minus debug. OK, let's see. Localhost is next. Well, let's suspend. Now I'm inside the script. I'm actually at a breakpoint. Let's see what's inside computer. Okay, localhost. What was in computer name, by the way? All right, two localhosts. All right, now I know what I'm dealing with. I know what's really in there. Let's exit and allow it to continue. About to spew output. You know, suspend again. Let's take a look at that props and see what got put into there. Yep, that all looks right. Okay, we're going to exit and say yes to all and let the whole thing continue running. You can add those breakpoints as you create your tool, and then when you need to debug, they're already there. Just use minus debug and start running it. Seems sensible? How many of you might like to distribute these tools? Yeah, that's kind of why you're here, right? So here's the trick with PowerShell. We're going to make something called a module. There are two ways to load a module in PowerShell. The first, well, they both involve import module. If the module lives in the right place, you can just give PowerShell the name or even a name with a wildcard. But the module has to live in the directory where PowerShell is already looking for modules. Alternately, you can just give it the complete path and file name to the module. But if you're going to create a repository of these things in your environment, I would recommend picking one place to put them. Now, I understand they have this new technology where a server can actually expose its files to the rest of the network. File sharing or SMB or something they call it. The trick here is the PS module path environment variable. This is not part of PowerShell. PowerShell utilizes it, but it is a Windows environment variable, which means you can control its contents through a group policy and push it out to all your computers. Here are the only two paths included by default. Add a semicolon, right? Yeah, semicolon, and add your own UNC path, and PowerShell will also look in your centralized location. So that's the first trick to learn about this. Now let's actually turn this into a module. First of all, I need to wrap this entire thing in a function. Function get-osinfo. Bloop. Tab. End function. So now this is a function called get-osinfo. It's a script commandlet, or an advanced function. Now we're going to do a little save as action. This is the tricky bit. I'm going to put it in one of the two default locations, which is the one in my documents. I hope. Actually, you know, because of that documents library, has anybody ever been messed on that documents library in 7 and later? And, you know, because it's two directories. It's public and my. This needs to go in my. So I'm actually going to come down here and do it at the shell. It's weird how I trust this more. So here's the path. You need to create a folder called Windows PowerShell under your documents, then create a folder under there called modules, and then create a folder that will contain your module. This defines your module name. My module is named what? My tools. This is important because PowerShell is not terribly bright about this stuff. The magic only works if you line everything up in the right order, and the naming of the files and the folders is important. I now need to go in here and hit File, Save As. Now I have a feeling I can get to the right one. Maybe. I think they might be mapping this off somewhere. Yeah, I'm just going to go back to the... You know, I'm going to go back to the shell. Heck with all this. Copy. Test.ps1. And I need to name it mytools.psm1. This is crucial. The file name and the folder name have to match, or this won't work. Your directory to make sure it's there. Okay. Let's go back out. Get module minus list available. See it? It's the first one in the list. It's a script module. Import module my tools. Get-osinfo, computer name, localhost, minus verbose. Awesome. Now you've got a distributable tool. Because I put that in a function, that one script file, that one PSM1 file, can contain as many other functions as you want it to contain. By default, everything in there becomes visible to whoever loads the module. There is a way, if you have like little utility background functions and you want to put those in there, but you want them hidden or private, there is a way to do that as well. We're not going to dig into it, but there is a way to make things private. You can also use that module to define aliases, to define top-level variables that you might use to set preferences. There's a whole slew of extra things you can do. So, let me take about 5 minutes and take questions on that. And we're going to move on to the next step. Shoot.
Are we talking about the tool?
I'm doing this on PowerShell 2 right now. This is actually a Windows 7 machine running PowerShell 2. Everything here is the same on version 3. Since I made that... the parameter, so I understand. Since I made the parameter mandatory, if I run get-osinfo, it will still prompt me for the computer name. Okay, so if I run get-osinfo and just type a computer name, In functions, all parameters are positional, so you can specify them in the order you want. That would be my second parameter, which is my error log file. And that will still work, yeah. Not a huge fan of that, especially if it's going to get pasted into another script, because it's a lot harder for someone to look at that and figure out what's happening. But if you're just banging it out at the command line for your own purposes, go nuts. All the way in the back, sir. Do I cover this in my book? Depends on which book you mean. I just got finished writing three of them. In two of them, yes. So in the PowerShell scripting and tool making is what covers this entire narrative, plus more. And we are going to do some of the plus more. Cool? Yeah? Okay. Oh, where? You were behind the monitor. Do you have to load the module every time you open a new PowerShell window? Yes. How can you not do that? Excellent question. The way you would not do that is to go back into that same this same folder, Windows PowerShell. Make a script called profile.ps1. And now every time I open a new PowerShell session, it will run whatever commands happen to be in there. So if there's several modules you want loaded, you want it to change to a different directory, you want it to display a happy face that says, good morning, boss, whatever you want to do. So is there somewhere you can force that for everybody? You are after help about profiles. Anyone from Canada? It's a boot profiles on the Canadian machines. There are actually several locations, including two for all users, that go under System32 someplace, under PowerShell's installation folder. So yeah, you can do that there also. Oops. Are we good for now? Okay. We're actually going to loop back to that function in just a minute and do some more with it and that module. I want to pause for a moment and talk about GUIs. How many of you are excited about possibly building graphical user interfaces with PowerShell? All right, well, let's try and nip that in the bud. Windows PowerShell has got two mechanisms, two frameworks via which it can create a GUI. The first is called Windows Forms, and the second is called Windows Presentation Foundation. Both of those are part of the .NET framework and are therefore completely accessible to all of Windows PowerShell. I am not going to run you through building an entire GUI here, because doing it manually would take half a day. What I am going to do is show you what it looks like and then give you some advice for pursuing that. However, before I do that, let's cover some caveats. First of all, you cannot compile a PowerShell script into a standalone binary executable and then distribute it in such a way that it does not require PowerShell to run. If that is your goal, there is a technology called C# that you should look into. Go down to the expo hall and find the big purple car and talk to those guys about Visual Studio. What PowerShell can do is, within a script, create a graphical dialog box, surface it, use that maybe to collect some input from a user, I don't know, whatever crazy thing you kids do these days, and then it can spew output. The output is often easy. How many of you can imagine that most of the time your output is going to be in some sort of tabular grid Excel spreadsheet-like format, yeah? Oh, you know what? Didn't I do get OS info? Is that still in here? Awesome. Right? Out grid view is your friend. Now, this has a dependency. It does. It's only available on machines where the PowerShell ISE, the integrated scripting environment, is installed. So your client computers, typically, that's where it's going to be. The ISE is not installed by default on servers because we're trying not to be standing at the server console, so we don't need a GUI there all the time, right? That's what we're going to do. But if you want to just pipe something out to OutGridView, this is probably the easiest way to get GUI output for a user. This is pretty cool, too. It's sortable. You can click on these things. You can add filtering criteria to, you know, only show me ones where the SP version, let's only add those. SP version is one, and I mean, you know, you can put all this stuff here, and it's really quite powerful. So that's a nice thing to work with. So that's the output side of it. The input side is a little bit trickier-y. Let's open up another script. GUIs in Windows. So I'm going to be discussing one of the frameworks for a GUI, and that's Windows Forms, because from a coding standpoint, it's a little easier to deal with. The other one is Windows Presentation Foundation. Go find a developer and ask them which one is better, and take a coffee with you, and a cocktail, and a book to read. Because there's a lot of strong opinions on one side or the other. I don't care. I'm just showing you one of them because it's one of the ones that's easier to wrap your head around initially. Essentially, what you do is you create a form. This represents a window. New object, type name, system.windows.forms.form. And then you start setting its properties. I want the text for it to be enter some info, and I want the form border style to be 3, which I believe is a fixed dialog box. And then I'm going to create a button. Actually, I don't need those square brackets there. .windows.forms.button. And then I want the button text to be OK. And I want the button top to be 30 character or pixels down, and the button left to be 200 pixels in, and the button height to be 50. And everybody see how this gets tedious? Then you've got to decide what you want to happen when the button gets clicked. And so usually you'll put that into a variable. So this is a script block with these curly brackets here. And I'm just going to run a PowerShell command, get event log, log name, whatever was in my text box. I haven't created that yet, but I plan to. Newest 50, out grid view. But now I have to create the text box. Text box, new object, type name, .windows.forms.textbox. You guys see where this is going? Right, this is why I'm not going to walk you through the entire thing. I don't want to stand up here and tell you that this is a great thing to do, but you can totally do it this way. Yes? Change louder. Change the P. Oh, yeah. This is so not going to work anyway. Here's the thing. I never hand code these GUIs because it takes too long. The first time I did one of these, has anybody read a book Jeff Hicks and I authored called Windows PowerShell TFM? Anybody have that? Okay, there's a whole chapter on this, and we hand-coded the whole GUI. And you know what I spent 6 hours doing? Fiddling with the left and the top and the height of everything. Run it? No. 10 more over. No. 10 more over. I swear you could just hire someone, like an intern, to sit around and mess with those all the time. So, from a practical standpoint, if this is something you need to do, you are going to have to spend some money to do it. The only solution that I am aware of on the market today that lets you graphically drag around GUI elements and then spews the necessary PowerShell code for you is called PowerShell Studio, and it's made by Sapien. Those guys are downstairs if you want to talk to them. At the time we wrote TFM, Jeff and I both worked for Sapien. And that chapter is, I think, what led us to the VP of development's door, where we begged him and begged him and begged him to please do something about this. This is terrible, and it's killing us. So as far as I'm aware, that's the only tool that does that. There are some other tools out there if you choose to go the other direction, such as with Windows Presentation Foundation. I want to give you just a URL here. It's called Show UI. That is sort of a simple, and you run a bunch of PowerShell commands to construct the UI, but you are still hand fiddling, p- positioning and text and all these other properties. It is still very fiddly and takes a while. What I eventually came down to was, for me, it was worth my time and money to just have a tool that did it. Now, you can also, if you're interested, look at, go here. This is an older version of that PowerShell Studio product that is free. So it is not as fully functional, but it does let you graphically arrange the GUI as you want it. You can attach your commands to whatever things you want to run, and then it will spew the PowerShell code for you. Some of the things that the bigger version does that I have found helpful in my consulting is it lets me package the whole thing into an executable that can run under alternate credentials. PowerShell still has to be installed, but that way when a user runs it, it elevates its process, and then they get a GUI. And to them, it feels like an application. They don't know any different. They're users. Bleh. But it looks like an app to them. It's got an icon. You know, you can tag it with elevated privileges, so it'll carry the little UAC shield if necessary. So I have found that to be useful. If you want to do it absolutely for free, there's the Community Edition. And if you just don't want any tools at all and you do not value your own time, this is what hand coding it looks like. Anyone ever hand coded a GUI in PowerShell like this? Yeah? Were you coming looking for a better way? Because aside from a tool, there's unfortunately not one. So, I hate to stand up at a session like this and say, look, if that's what you want to do, you got to go spend money. But right now, aside from their Community Edition, that's just what it is. If you've got Visual Studio, you can use a copy of Visual Studio. Put it in C# mode. It requires less translation. Like, get the C# Express Visual Studio, which they don't make anymore. Use it to drag and drop your GUI, and then the C# code it generates can be hand-translated fairly easily to PowerShell. So, I mean, that's another way you could go. I found that to be time-consuming as well. So, any questions on the GUI stuff? Because we got about 15 minutes, and there's a few more things I need to show you on the other tool. Yes?
The PowerShell Studio that Sapien makes?
Yes. Yes, anything that compiles PowerShell into an executable, because there are several tools that do that, still have PowerShell as a dependency.
Right, now, will that executable that you can distribute, assuming the user has PowerShell, does the user have to have all the libraries pre-installed, or will the executable install those libraries?
If your script has some dependency, like a module, that needs to be on that machine already. It will not summon all that together. Can you have, so Metro, I have no idea. I hear that and all I think is JavaScript, so I don't know. I will tell you this, PowerShell is just a .NET class. I am not running PowerShell here. I'm running an application called PowerShell ISE that actually is written in WPF that engages PowerShell behind the scenes. Any .NET application can instantiate PowerShell, start a run space, create a pipeline, shove a command, and get objects back. That's how the Exchange Server GUI is written. That's how the new Server Manager GUI is written. So if you're a .NET coder, yeah, you can leverage PowerShell that way. Scanning, sneaking behind the monitor, okay. A couple other things I want to show you in this main tool here before we go away. And I need to open the right one now. Well, no, I don't. We talked about private functions. How many of you can see maybe having a private function in here that you don't want exposed to the world, but yeah, okay, might as well show you how to do that. Here's the default behavior. When someone imports a module, if there are no export module member commands, then everything in the module becomes public or visible. As soon as you export module member anything, from this point on, only the things I have exported will be seen by the person who loads the module. Anything else in the module becomes implicitly private. So it's a switch, right? It's everything or clunk, only the things you say. And it's just designed for ease of use that way. So if you do need to protect something, that's how you can do it. For example, new alias, name Gauze E. What could go wrong? git os info. And now I'll export that alias. But I'm also going to create another little function in here just to prove it. Now I'm going to copy that over. Oh, yes, you can. Oh, I'm copying the whole folder. I can see where that would be bad. There we go. The little trick when you update a module, PowerShell only reads a module when you tell it to read the module. So you need to remove the module and then re-import the module. And if I look at PowerShell's function drive, I should see get OS info, and I should not see get nothing, and I don't. So that get nothing function, because I did not explicitly export it, is now hidden and is considered private. And let's see if my Gauzy works. It does. Good. Now there's lots of other things you can do as a toolmaker. How many of you have ever run get process in PowerShell? Okay, for those of you who haven't, here's what it looks like. This layout, these eight columns, are created by an XML file called a view. You might well want to create such an XML file for the output of your own commands so that their default output is a little more pleasant or customized. You can absolutely do that. We're not going to dig into the entire XML here. There's lots of resources out there, including the book, several websites that document that. But the trick to it is you can only apply one of those if your object has a custom object type name. So I want to show you how to do that. Most organizations are going to come up with some kind of naming scheme that starts with your organization's name and then a dot and maybe a department, just so that you can make sure nobody is walking on each other so you don't get conflicts. You don't want anyone using the same thing twice. That's how you apply a custom name to this thing. With a custom name, you can then go in and create the XML for a custom view. You can also do type extensions, which are dynamically added properties and methods that you write in PowerShell script and get added again through an XML configuration file by the shell at runtime. So there's several different features that are keyed off of using this custom type name. So I wanted to make sure you saw how to do that as well. If you run get member on your output, you will see my custom OS info thing. I can prove it if you want. I'm not afraid. Means I have to copy this back again. I keep making changes to that one, don't know why. Gauzy localhost GM. Ha! You will notice that because of the way I've created this custom object, all of my properties are note properties. That's going to be the case for 99% of what you do. That just means it's a static piece of information because we are not deriving this from one of the underlying .NET framework classes. We've just custom cobbled this thing together essentially ad hoc. So that can still be treated in every way, shape, and form like a real object, though. I can pipe it to anything I want to. You guys want to see it in a table instead? That's what it would look like in a table. Kind of losing some information there, so let's have it auto size. That looks better. If it wrapped anything, we could let it wrap as well. So you can treat it just like any other PowerShell output, pipe it to anything else to format it, export it, convert it, filter it even, for example. Here's a great use of this. Let's only keep the ones where the OS version is equal to 6.1.7601, and where the SP version is not equal to 1. No output. So you might use that to say, hey, I need to get a bunch of computers, and I need to get the ones that are running this version but haven't been service packed. No news here is good news. It means everything met the criteria, so I didn't have any output. So again, by creating these custom objects and by outputting that to the shell, you really leverage PowerShell's ability to do lots of different stuff with it from there. So the last thing I want to leave you with is sort of a broader architectural look at writing tools for PowerShell. What you've seen me do is create a module that contains a function that is a do something function. This is not producing output to be used by something else, right? It's not getting computer names or anything else. This is taking input and doing something with it. This is not taking that and then formatting it or converting it. This is the middle function. You are also going to write a larger type of script. This automates a task. That task might be applicable to many different processes that you find yourself involved with. So you're also going to find yourself writing a script that simply calls a bunch of commands in order and perhaps produces output on the screen or to a database or something else to automate an entire process, and that's fine as well. Just keep those things separate. Try and build your individual tasks as these reusable functions and then utilize them in specific processes as needed rather than trying to just chunk everything together in one less easily reused location, yeah? Okay, a few minutes for questions before we go. Any more? Yes?
How would I change that to run against each machine?
So how would you have it run against machines in parallel? You would need to change the architecture of it a bit. Probably more than I can go into here, but you might run it as a job, for example. Guys, before you all head out, I want to make sure you get my contact information, so let me put this up on the screen for you. Gave you a bunch of templates, gave you a bunch of other stuff, and yes. Okay, Twitter feed will have the URL to download all this stuff. I'll make sure it gets up there. Sapien is the folks that do that other tool. And if you need anything else, if you wanted to grab one of these coupons for the video training, they're up here. If we run out, I'll make sure that gets into my Twitter stream as well. And if anybody wants to ask a few more questions, please meet me outside. I need to get off stage for the next speaker, so I'm going to go right out into the hallway, and I'll be happy to help you there. Thank you.